when the Biden administration took office and they immediately shut down the Keystone Pipeline.
When you have a small town that revolves around that one industry and then that industry is stolen from you, what happens is everybody now falls into institutional poverty. Why is it green to put it on tankers and cargo it across the ocean? What the hell is happening in these conversations? Now we're getting our oil, gas, and coal from foreign countries, from China, from Venezuela, and Iran.
Who controls AI is basically going to control the world at some point.
It's the first time ever in the history of humanity that power or energy equals intelligence. We need a lot of power, and we need power very, very quickly. So we're absolutely in a new Cold War. And the way we are going to win this Cold War, the strategy President Trump has employed, is using energy, especially oil, as leverage. In the case of our adversaries, when they're energy rich, it's violence, it's war, it's terrorism, it's bloodshed. And so that's the difference between us and them, and that's why we have to win.
Welcome to Proud American Studios for a new episode of The Forum. I'm your host, Trey Lindsay, along with my co-host, Mike Koselniak. Today, we are going to talk about energy, the new Cold War, and its geopolitical impacts. We are very happy to have Daniel Turner, founder of Power of the Future, with us today. Daniel, please tell us a little bit about yourself and what is Power of the Future, and also how it relates to the Heartland.
Yeah, well, it's great to be with you all, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. I started Power of the Future about 8 years ago, and I started it really because of coal miners in West Virginia. This is the end of the Obama administration's war on coal, and there's a lot of that's happened in coal in the last couple of weeks, and I'm sure we'll get into it in this conversation. But you know, I live on a sheep farm in rural Virginia. I'm close to Appalachia. I knew a lot of folks in this industry, and you would go into these coal towns and you would see what would happen when outside forces from Washington, D.C. or New York City, under the guise of climate change or whatever it was, when they would shut down your one industry, right? When you have a small town in especially coal, or, you know, the same with textiles or furniture making or steel, when you have a small town that revolves around that one industry and then that industry is stolen from you, what happens is everybody now falls into institutional poverty, right? You can't leave because the one commodity you have is your house, and no one's buying your house because no one's moving into the town. So you're stuck in that town. Your school is closed for your kids because there's no more tax revenue. And I've seen this happen. And that's when you start getting these problems of depression and alcoholism and suicide and domestic violence. And we were doing this to coal miners all over the country. We're doing it to energy workers. And again, climate change was the excuse. We're going to stop the climate change, but we were destroying the livelihoods and the culture and the well-being of hundreds of thousands of Americans. And I was in political battles, and I just felt like I had to get off the sideline. So I wanted to create an organization that could be a voice for these folks in power circles, in national media, on podcasts like this, and tell their story. So that's the birth of Power of the Future.
Awesome. Yeah, like, I've driven through Western Virginia numerous times. Absolutely gorgeous country. So I know exactly where the coal mine areas and how you know, the folks that live there as well. Again, you mentioned the coal mines being shut down. I'm guessing it's probably very similar when the Biden administration took office and they immediately shut down the Keystone Pipeline, where it was how many thousands of workers were laid off at a pretty much with a stroke of a pen. I'm sure like they struggled a lot along in the Dakotas and other areas that the Keystone Pipeline was directly affected with as well.
Yeah, it really was. And you know, the bad thing about Keystone was obviously the initial impact to the 14,000 men and women who were working in that. You know, people were saying, well, these are construction jobs, right? So of course they were going to end eventually. And yeah, there's some truth to that. Construction jobs aren't permanent. But Biden sent a market signal, and he said, don't build a pipeline because I'm not going to approve it. And so when I talked to welders who were on Keystone, they say, look, Keystone had another year and a half to go. But in the last 6 months of this job, like, like anyone in construction knows. In the last 6 months of that job, you're lining up the next job. And maybe we're going to leave Houston. We're all going to drive to Oklahoma. And then after Oklahoma, we spend 6 months in Louisiana, et cetera. But Biden sent this signal to said there will be no more natural gas pipeline building. So those guys, yeah, they lost their immediate job, but they lost their future job, right? They lost. And you know what they did? They lost their hope. Because this is what you do when you're 55 and yeah, you make a really good fortune because these welders are, but you have 35 years of expert technical ability that you can't learn through AI, right? You can't pick it up in a book, and you pay these people handsomely for this, and you took away their livelihood. And what did, you know, John Kerry say? Now you can get a job in the green economy, right? Or they say, yeah, you they say things like
programming, I think was one of the comments he made.
Learn to code, right?
That's one of those code.
There's a cruelness there. There's a cruelty that I hated seeing that what they did to energy workers, right? They just dismissed it. Like, again, climate change, we don't care about you, your culture, your livelihood, your family, your mortgage. We have bigger, we have more grandiose things to think about. And I hated seeing what we did to regular, hardworking Americans.
So, Daniel, in these towns, the jobs leave, right? So what happens? It kind of creates a vacuum in these towns in the heartland across America. What happens in these towns with their communities and the drug issues and all those? Could you address that topic a little bit?
Yeah. And it's devastating, right? Because when people have no hope, that's when they turn to vices, right? The opioid epidemic timed with the war on coal. And the opioid epidemic was strongest in three areas. It was West Virginia. It was Northwest New Mexico, which was a huge coal area that was destroyed as well. It was Southeast Kentucky, Southeast Ohio. And you take away people's hope and they turn to opioids because they're cheap. And they pack a hell of a punch. And when you're broke, that's what you go for, right? You did see spikes in suicide. And you know what they do is they tell these folks that now you're the problem of the state. So people run for governor like, I don't want the state to have to step. I want these people to have their livelihood, because at the same time, and this is where we get into the national security conversation, and I didn't think of national security when I started Power of the Future, trust me. I just thought about these men and women in these towns. But at the same time, now we're getting our oil, gas, and coal from foreign countries. We're getting it from China. We're getting it from Malaysia. We're buying oil from Venezuela and Iran. Biden bought millions of barrels of oil from Iran. So it's like, not only are we hurting our fellow Americans, we're enriching our adversaries at the same time. And you scratch your head. I joke, I used to have a full head of hair when I started this job. You look at this and you say, what the hell is happening in these conversations? And, you know, I got tired of politicians bantering. I was like, I'm going to start my own thing, say what the hell needed to be said with no fear of repercussions. And that's where we are.
So, Daniel, the oil, gas, and coal industry is constantly being targeted here in the United States. Is it really about the environment and climate science, or is it about control? Because if you control energy, you control everything.
Yeah, you really do. Energy is everything, right? The first thing you did this morning, probably when you woke up, is like you looked at your alarm clock or your phone. Right. And that's electricity and it's power. And you turn on the light and it's electricity. You put on the coffee maker and it's electricity. That, you know, your hot shower, everything you do revolves around electricity. And I firmly believe that industry, the energy industry, is the last great industry in private hands. And it's why if you're a statist, and that's a polite way to say a communist, right? But if you're a statist, you genuinely believe that should be in control of government. Obama thought healthcare should be in the control of government. He did not like private sector healthcare. So he was like, government is going, that's what Obamacare is. We are going to control the healthcare industry. Energy is the last great industry that is not in government hands. Yeah, there are some publicly traded companies and things like that. But your oil company, when you go fill up your car, right, you're not going to a state-run industry, right? When you're turning on your electricity, the utilities are a little nebulous, right? But it's the private sector that's delivering your propane, or that's, you know, your furnace, et cetera. And the left hates that. They have to control this. Look at every single dictator from Stalin to Hitler to Chairman Mao to Hugo Chavez. The first thing you do when you get power after you kill all the professors, right? And the press, the next thing you do is you take over the energy industry. You nationalize energy because it controls people's movements. It controls their transportation. It controls everything. And again, the statists hate the fact that freedom determines our energy industry, not the state.
Daniel, you brought up a really good point earlier about under the Biden administration, we lowered our own domestic oil production, but we were buying it from Venezuela, was it Russia, you know, China, other places around the globe. I read multiple, you know, articles and also saw, you know, multiple, you know, news specials on this topic. Again, they did that in the name of climate change. But at the same time, the oil they're buying from Venezuela, in Russia and other places was not nearly as purified as what was coming from the U.S., domestic oil production. And it was actually far way worse for the environment, us buying additional oil from other places. How do we had to refine it more and everything else like that? Can you explain that to our viewers and with your expertise, you've been the subject matter expert of how that really was, how almost had a negative effect even more so on the environment than what, even though they were pushing it, you know, under the Green New Deal, you know, fraud, I would call it.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And now you're getting into a little bit of the technical side of energy, which I think is fascinating, but not all crude is the same, right? You hear the expression light, sweet crude. Normally crude is judged by two things. It's viscosity, how thick it is, and its level of sulfur, right? So it's sulfuric. America is very blessed. I think our Gulf Coast, the Gulf of America oil tends to be the best, which that means that this sludge that comes from underground to turn it into the millions of products that we need to is a less intensive process, right? All refining is labor intensive. It's hydrocarbon intensive. It's energy intensive. And it gets refined into whether it's jet fuel or propane or car gasoline, right? Et cetera. The oil that comes from other countries is denser, it's thicker, and it has more sulfur. We can turn it into whatever we need to. It just takes a longer, and it's more expensive to do that. And the other thing, it has to be transported here, right? So I never understood when Biden was like, we're not going to get gas from Midland or oil from Midland, Texas, but we are going to get it from, you know, Mauritania. It's like, well, why? Why is it green to put it on tankers and cargo it across the ocean? Why is that better for the environment if you believe this emissions game that they like to play? So we're blessed to have really good oil in America and a huge abundance of it. We don't need the rest of the world when it comes to our energy. They need us, quite frankly.
Not to mention the other countries, I'm sure they have very little oversight on environmental impacts. So a quick compare to the American energy companies do. But this is actually a really good segue into our next question for you. Please. So America is energy rich. Are we sitting on massive reserves that policy just keeps locked away? And if we don't produce the energy ourselves, are we just empowering some of our adversaries that don't share our same values?
100%. It's a great question. There is more natural gas in Pennsylvania to power America and our allies for well over a century. And that's just Pennsylvania. New York has a fracking ban, a natural gas ban. New York State has technically more natural gas reserves than Pennsylvania does. And bad policy is preventing upstate New York from looking like Western PA, where quality of life is better, residential property is higher, quality of life, incomes are higher, right? Like Western PA is doing better than that imaginary line of the New York PA border. It's all bad policy. But, you know, the amount of coal reserves we have, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of coal just in Wyoming, let alone Alaska, right? There's more oil and gas in California than we need. California used to be the second largest oil producer in the country after Texas. It's now, I think, seventh. And that's only because of policy. And that means that the people of California are just missing out on their slice of the pie, right? We're using more oil and gas than ever before, but California's slice is now smaller and other slices are bigger. And that stinks if you're a Californian.
So we've talked a little bit about some of our adversaries. So Russia, Iran, China, With your experience in the energy industry, do you think energy revenues directly fund military expansion from some of our adversaries and also, you know, just general geopolitical aggression as a whole within the region?
Yeah. I'll always say energy is everything. And America is blessed to have a really diversified economy, right? Our energy sector is huge, of course. But it's just a portion of our economy. When you look at some of those petro states, like all the Middle Eastern countries, Russia at 75-80% of its GDP, their entire economy depends upon that one sector. And so if they produce more of it and prices are high, they become rich. And sadly, when bad guys get rich, they do bad things, right? So go back to 2021, Biden's newly inaugurated. Within a couple of days, he lifts all the sanctions on Iran. Iran, at the end of the first Trump administration, was refining around 250,000 barrels of oil a day, and the price was around $58 a barrel. By the end of the Biden administration, they were refining over 3 million barrels a day at closer to $85.90. So the delta there is around $270 million a day, right? And what does Iran do with that, right? It build schools for girls, right? No, of course it doesn't. Like it foments terrorism, right? Yeah, yep. That's the sad thing. Like if Iran
at
was
arms,
a good
at arms Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, exactly. Just to name a few. So
if they were good countries that had good leaders and were rooted in Judeo-Christian principles, they'd be prosperous like Persia used to be, right? Mm-hmm. But they're not. And so when bad guys get a lot of money and power, they do bad things with it. That shouldn't surprise us. And so what did Russia do? You know, there's that famous photo, and I love to point at it all the time. It's early 2018 when a newly inaugurated Donald Trump is his first trip to Europe. And he tells the European Union leaders, if you don't stop buying Russian oil and gas, you are signing your death sentence. Remember, he's sitting defiantly against on the chair, and on the other side of the aisle is Merkel and Macron, and they're pointing, and it's a very contentious. It looks like it was painted by a Renaissance artist, right? The juxtaposition. But Trump is very defiant. 2 years later, or 3 years later, as soon as Trump was out of office, what did Russia do? It invaded Ukraine. Why? Because it had hundreds of billions of dollars that the French, Italian, Spanish, Germans,
the EU, the European Union countries bought.
They bought it, right? Because so energy is everything. It's one of the eternal questions I'll have for God is why did some of the world's worst states develop above so many oil reserves, right? Like America's great. We're the ultimate force for good. Canada's having some problems, but Canada's still a good guy overall. But otherwise, the countries that have a ton of oil, bad, 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 like across the board. I don't know why the geography is the way it is. That's a question for God. But I know that when they are rich, the world is in danger.
So, Daniel, you mentioned President Trump warning Europe about Russian gas. Looking back, did energy dependence make Europe strategically vulnerable? And should America learn from that mistake?
Yeah, it really did, because they couldn't confront Russia with the aggression they wanted to, because Putin always threatened to cut them off. And at the same time, President Trump in his first administration was trying desperately to sell oil and natural gas to our European allies. There were plans for a huge natural gas a refinery, a transportation hub in Maryland. It was shut down by a Republican governor, sadly. I always point it out, because bad energy policy is bipartisan stupidity, right? But the purpose of that Baltimore natural gas hub was to bring pipelines from Pennsylvania, compress it, put it on tankers, and go sell it to Europe. And if they're buying ours, they're not buying Russian. And we're not going to invade Europe anytime too soon, right? So why wouldn't you want to buy it from us rather than enriching your enemy? So and Europe did this again. They really did slit their own throats. England has a tremendous amount of oil and gas reserves, but they have an 87% tax on the oil and gas they get from the North Sea. They've shut down almost all of their platforms, and they've shut off most of their coal. I mean, the Industrial Revolution was born in the UK with coal. They were the ones who really brought it to fruition, and they have tremendous coal reserves, but they've shut them all down. So for what benefit, right? To make Russia richer and stronger. And so yeah, bad energy policy has just made them weak and dependent. Probably the best example, which is just in lunacy, is when Angela Merkel shut down the nuclear refineries in Germany after the Fukushima tsunami in Japan. And mm-hmm. she said that was a warning to the world of what can happen. And you want to say, Angela, if Germany is worried about a tsunami, like your nuclear reactors are the least of your problem if a tsunami hits Germany. I got to tell you, that was the level of stupidity, that you're taking away your reliable, you know, baseline power because of a tsunami that hit Japan. So just pure insanity made them weak and dependent.
So, Daniel, you actually brought up a very good point. I think our viewers would like for you to expound on a little bit more. When you talk about the UK's energy policy, how they, like, the amount of reserves they have from, you know, oil, gas, coal, you name it. Who exactly within Parliament over there, who exactly was the politicians making those decisions at the time that really kind of pigeonholed them the way it sounds as far as their energy independence?
Yeah, I mean, it was all Labour Party policies. It really started back with Tony Blair some 20 years ago, without a doubt. But Labour, the party which is currently in power, is constantly pushing this. Their John Kerry is a guy named Ed Miliband. He is their climate change czar. And he will say with a straight face that right now they are pursuing the policies that are bringing down prices and will bring stability. England has the highest electricity rates of any of the developed nations. They pay almost four times what we pay for electricity in the United States. And it is literally shutting down industry nationwide. But they will look at you with a straight face and say, we are on the right path towards a better, greener England. And I think if you don't believe in Western values, if you don't believe that your country is a force for good, the diminishing of your country is a value. They don't see their countries as forces for good, so they are happy to bring them down to the misery of the rest of the world.
Very good insight there. We really appreciate that. Circling back around to Iran, obviously Iran's making the headlines a lot these days for multiple reasons. Yeah. Though, when Iran does increase their oil exports, how do you think that directly strengthens the regime? And also, from your perspective, how tightly linked is their energy revenues and to be able to be in a bad actor to destabilize the area of the Persian Gulf, the Middle East as a whole, or even the world for that matter?
Yeah, and it really is. It's their only main source of revenue, and it generates a lot. They are a very oil-rich nation, and so what President Trump has tried to do is diminish their customer base, right? Their sanctions are back on, and he's let other countries know that even if you buy Iranian oil through third-party mediaries, we're still going to tariff you and punish you economically. Because what Iran was doing, especially under the Biden regime, they'd be like, hey, look, we're not selling oil and gas to England, but they would sell to either India or South Korea or Turkey. Turkey, right? Who was part of NATO. That's a whole conversation for another time. No, but Turkey.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And then they were upselling it with a small premium to Spain, to England, to Italy, to France. And again, they were just getting around these sanctions. And that's what the regime was dependent upon for all of its wealth. There's no surprise that in the 4 years of Biden, you would see these headlines against tensions in the Straits of Hormuz, the Houthi rebels in Yemen. Where did all this come from, right? It's all fomented by this one regime, and the oil is their only source of revenue. Cut off the oil, cut off the regime.
Yeah, real quick, hey, for the viewing audience, so we talk about the Strait of Hormuz. That's that small little narrow tip that kind of is the Gulf of from the Gulf of Oman that leads into the Persian Gulf that borders Iran. And then we talked about the Houthis. That is the Shiite-backed militant group in Yemen that was attacking all the U.S. ships, with the oil tankers and other cargo ships in the Red Sea, and also kind of getting a little bit even closer towards the Suez Canal at times, depending on exactly where those attacks were taking place. So I just wanted to clarify exactly some of the different groups and regions of the world that were hotspots. It was being covered a lot in the news when those attacks were going on. It's safe to say that every single one of those attacks, whether it was from the Strait of Hormuz or if it was in the Red Sea done by the Houthis, was backed by Iranian oil money in one way or the other. You think that's a fair assessment to say?
Oh, 100%. And that's what they do with their with their wealth, right? Again, they don't enrich their people. They have a radical ideology, and their caliphate requires money to send it worldwide. And they also have a lot of customers. So North Korea, China, there's a lot of bad actors that don't have a domestic supply of oil, and they buy it from equally bad actors. And so, you know, again, dry up the oil, control the oil, control the bad guys from ever getting powerful to begin with.
Well, switching gears here a little bit, let's talk about Venezuela. Because obviously Venezuela, when the arrest of Maduro caused national headlines, rightfully so. Is Venezuela just an oil issue in your opinion? Or do you think it's part of a larger hemispheric power struggle involving China and other authoritarian regimes that are definitely our adversaries?
Yeah, I don't want to expose President Trump's thinking here, and I could be completely wrong, but my hunch has always been that Venezuela was completely about China, and he can defeat China the way Reagan defeated the Soviet Union by using the economy and making them go bankrupt. China does not have a domestic supply of oil. Most of their Belt and Road Initiative, as it's called, most of their strategic allies are for metals and minerals, but especially oil and gas, which they need to power their economy to make all the plastic crap that we buy that finances China. Venezuela was a huge client of China. They sold most of their oil to China. So if you control Venezuela and you have all of these naval blockades on the oil, now China doesn't get any oil from there. Now China's in a pickle. And if you're Chairman Xi, you have to make up several million barrels a day and you have to get it from somewhere else. And that's driving up oil prices in your country, which makes it harder to manufacture, which foments unrest and all of that nonsense. I don't think people realize that China's not the stable regime that it portrays. That China can be pushed pretty darn easily, and the economy is the way to do it. And also China is our number one adversary. So without having to say the word China, Trump is punishing China, and he can on the record say, "I love Chairman Xi, great relation." I don't try to do a Trump impression. I don't do a good one, but right, like great relation, great respect. But all of these little things he's done, tariffs, rare earths and metals, which hopefully we get a chance to talk about, oil, all of these things are making China very, very economically weak. And that is good for world peace.
Do you think this is a cold war in the Western Hemisphere against our adversaries over energy?
We're absolutely in a new cold war. And rather than the Soviet Union, it's another communist superpower, and it's China. And the way we are going to win this cold war, the strategy President Trump has employed, is using energy, especially oil, as leverage. And if you can control the world's oil, you can stop the bad guys from becoming rich and powerful. And that's exactly what we're doing. And that is good for world peace. That is good for prosperity and freedom worldwide.
Daniel, China imports a massive amount of oil. Are they vulnerable to energy checkpoints? And does the U.S. production weaken Beijing's leverage globally?
It's their biggest vulnerability, is their lack of domestic oil. That's why they're trying to build pipelines desperately to Pakistan. But there's a problem, is that there's countries in between that don't necessarily want the pipelines through them, right? And their other ally is Russia, but their oil fields in Russia are really far from where China needs oil. So oil is by far China's greatest vulnerability, and weakening China through just controlling the world's oil markets is the best way to bring about world peace. We talk all the time about the tensions in the South Chinese Sea, Taiwan, et cetera, et cetera. North Korea launching missiles over Korea itself. All of that is Chinese influence, and a weak China is good for world peace.
Can you discuss a little bit about China's focus on the EV industry and how the Chinese government can control EV and tech?
I am not anti-EV. I'll make that really clear. I would never personally own one, but there's a reason why China is pushing EVs. And you'll see the environmental left say things like China leads the world on EV purchases per capita. And that's 100% true. They do. But we have to be realistic. They don't do this for climate change and they don't do it for the planet. They do it for two reasons. One, I just said, they are incredibly vulnerable when it comes to oil. They don't have a domestic oil supply. So gasoline for vehicles is expensive in China, but they have a ton of coal and they have a ton of electricity. So that's the one reason why they want to push EVs. And the second one are EVs are very easy for the state to shut down. And China uses their social credit scores and to determine whether or not your EV will start that day. They can use their EV to track your location. If they don't like the fact that you're going to this house over and over again, maybe your EV won't work that day. And we can do that here in America as well. Luckily, we have some protections and some safeguards. I don't think that they're enough for me, which is why I would never own an EV. Plus, they're weak, right? They don't have nearly the hauling capacity, the towing capacity, the durability, but freedom is a wonderful thing. Buy an EV if you want one. I'm not going to. But the idea that you can control someone's vehicle and the country, the government of China does all the time, scares the crap out of me. And that is the main reason why China loves EV. It is population control.
Shifting gears just a little bit, going back to President Trump. He's constantly saying that energy dominance is control. What does this mean strategically?
Yeah, control the oil, control the world. And that is the most important thing America can do as the ultimate force for good. I think for too long, and I know most of you gentlemen and your audience have really robust military careers, and we thank you for your service. But for too long in this country, we've seen the world be a flipping disaster. And then when it gets to a breaking point, everyone looks at America and they're like, can you come bail us out, right? Can you come to the rescue? I think President Trump is saying, how about we prevent that? How about we stop the bad guys from becoming rich and powerful to begin with? We use the example of Iran and Russia under the Biden administration. Both of them got a lot of oil and gas money. They use that revenue to foment war. What was the first thing the European Union did on Russia is America, what are you going to do about it, right? We looked at the terrible attack on Israel. The world says, America, what are you going to do about it? President Trump is saying, how about before we send a whole bunch more farm boys over to die and other people's battles, we stop those battles from ever starting. And the way we do that is stopping the bad guys from ever becoming rich and powerful. I don't care if Vladimir Putin is insane. I care that he's insane with a boatload of money and weaponry. But if we can prevent the money from getting in his hands, if we can keep the Ayatollah broke, right? It's how Reagan ended the Soviet Union. He bankrupted them. So that is the point of energy dominance. Yes, it is prosperity for America. And of course, I'm always America first. A robust energy industry is cheaper goods. It's more prosperity and freedom for the American people. But it is also preventing us having to look at the world and say, we will bail you out again because you guys, like you did with Vladimir Putin, buy their oil and gas and make the bad guys rich and powerful. So control the oil, control the world.
Daniel, I'd like to circle back. I noticed something you said a little bit ago when you talked about China and the EVs and then pretty much being able to control them at the state level. So do you think, knowing that, know as much as you do about, the Chinese and their influence even over their people with the EVs, do you think that may have been a little bit of an end state or end goal for the Biden administration and the folks on the left of the political spectrum? Do you think that's what they're actually, the war on coal was potentially going towards, them having more control even over EVs, if they pretty much, pushed out, your standardized, gas or, diesel engines? Do you think that could have been an underlying issue, what they were trying to, their end state, their long goal was?
I think if you're a statist, you believe that the government should have control over people's lives. And if you can control energy from the state position, then you can control their movements. You can control their livelihoods. You can control their diet, right? You can control all industry because you don't believe in freedom. You believe in the power of government. So if you are Joe Biden, and I say statist because I'm trying to be a good Christian, right? But there's a much more evil word I could use about these people. If you believe in government, then you have to regulate all of that. Look, we saw this during COVID. I often joke that COVID was the precursor or the more intensified what the climate left has been trying to do for 50 years. We tell you if you're allowed to go to work. We tell you what days you're allowed to go to work, what direction of the supermarket you have to walk up and down, right? And we get everyone to comply. They've wanted to use energy to do this for the longest time. And we don't want people to have cars. We want them to get on trains, right? We want everyone to be on the railroad. I don't want to use the railroad. forward. I want to use the car. Nope, we're going to make it impossible. So actually, we're going to punish the combustion engine industry. We're going to ban a lot of the combustion engine, and we're going to force you to use something that we say is an equivalent, but it's not. But the energy for that depends upon us. It depends upon the government. And I don't want to depend upon the government for my autonomy. I don't want to depend upon the government for my leaf blower. You know, I live in the great Commonwealth of Virginia, home of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. And now the lunatic who's our governor has a proposal to ban electric leaf, gas-powered leaf blowers. I mean, level of minutia that these people are so committed to their agenda. You're going to tell me what freaking machine I can use to blow leaves on my farm? That level of control they love, and they want to do this across all levels. What you eat, what you use, the tools you have, the light bulbs you have, the ceiling. Remember the ceiling fan controversies? The generator. They believe that they are the ultimate force of good, the government, and they determine everything. And your job is to obey. And, you know, we're a couple months away from a 250th anniversary of a revolution where we said, enough of this crap. No one is going to have this power over us. But yet there's a huge percentage of liberal Democrats in this country that want that power back.
So, Daniel, you bring up a very good point about what's going on in the state of Virginia now. Not to start talking about politics at the national level, but you want to see what would happen in the United States if the Democrats ever took back both chambers of Congress and also the White House. Look no further than what's going on in the state of Virginia currently and what the House of Delegates, the Virginia Senate, and what the governor's office is proposing with new legislation.
So, Daniel, let's go back to the Western Hemisphere and let's talk about Cuba. Can you tell us a little bit about that and their fossil fuel situation?
There's an embargo right now of fossil fuels making it to Cuba, not just out of Venezuela, but anything reaching the island. And what's happening there is a tragedy, but it's also a tragedy of 60, 70 years in the making, right? I mean, Bay of Pigs was a very, very long time ago, and Cuba has been a thorn in the side of the Western Hemisphere and a breeding ground of communism in the Western Hemisphere for decades and decades. And so I think if you're Donald Trump, you look back at the Monroe Doctrine, as he calls it now, the Donroe Doctrine. And he says, why are we allowing our neighboring states, our neighboring countries to become these breeding grounds of hostility towards us, right? And the Soviet Union collapsed, but then China rose, and they have been using Cuba to their advantage as well. So, you know, half of Cuba lives in America, and I think those folks would love to go back to their own country if we could give them a country, if they could have a country that was hospitable and that was free and that was prosperous. So much of President Trump's agenda also is using energy strategically to make their countries great again. I said earlier, how great would it be if Iran was not run by evil people? They have so much wealth. They could be a great force for good, and Cuba could be the exact same way. And President Trump is using leverage to push it in that direction.
Daniel, let's switch gears and talk about Greenland. Like, why does Greenland matter? And as you think it's all about the rare earth minerals, the Arctic positioning where Greenland strategically sits and the blocking of Chinese expansions, or you think it's even more of an issue on just America energy independence potentially, but even American security as a whole?
Geographically, it's strategic. Its location is incredibly strategic. You know, China calls itself an Arctic nation, which if anyone has seen a map, it's clearly not. And yet they call itself an Arctic nation because they want a foothold in the Arctic. There's a ton of oil and gas in the Arctic that is yet undiscovered. The Russians have a large dominance there. The Norwegians are fighting them, not literally, but economically. And sometimes they're muscling each other out in international waters. So there's a geographic strategic location, but the rare earths are absolutely essential, and there's an abundance of them there. You know, go back to the early 90s, the then premier of China, Deng Xiaoping, said, the Middle East has oil, but China has rare earths. Right. And this is the beginning of the computer age, and everyone was getting a Commodore 64. Right. And the very trace elements of rare earths were starting to be necessary for market share. China took took advantage of that, and they dominate 90 to 95% of the world's rare earth markets. And we're pushing obviously more in that direction for military, for smart technology, for AI, all of that. If we can have a dominance of the AI market or just a better hold of it, and Greenland being a key to that, again, it's another way to weaken China. So it's a geographic location because of Russia, because of China. It's a market location for these rare earth elements. It's expanding American reach and using America as a force for good. So it was funny that see the European Union, they were like, we're going to send military to protect from an invasion. Did anyone really think Trump was going to send? And plus, even if he did, do you think the 20 Norwegians there were really going to be any match for SEAL Team mm-hmm. 6? Right. If we wanted Greenland, we would have taken it by now. But we got it, and we didn't have to do anything, right? He offered, what was the magic number? I forget the number, and Denmark shot it down. And in the last negotiation, they were like, all right, well, we'll give you what you want for no money. And Trump said, great, I got exactly what I wanted in Greenland, and it didn't cost me a dime. So who won in the end? America did, and that's good for the world.
So Daniel, do you really think that these Arctic routes and the resources and whatnot and Greenland and that those routes are the next strategic battlefield for the world?
I think so, because I think it's the one part of geography that is yet unexplored when it comes to oil and gas reserves. I spend a lot of time on the North Slope of Alaska. We know what's there to a certain extent, but there's a huge portion of Alaska that we still haven't explored, and we haven't even talked about Canada. So there are probably huge oil and gas reserves all through that area. I think that's why it's one of the last great unknowns. It's incredibly difficult terrain, right? I mean, I've only been there in the summer and it was still very, very cold. But I know guys who work there in the dead of winter when it is negative 40, and they do it, right? I mean, these are some tough SOBs and they're not afraid of some cold. So I think the Arctic is the last great unknown region. It makes sense for America to get there ahead of everybody else.
So there's a lot of talk about AI and the next, strategic, who controls AI is basically going to control the world at some point. Yeah. What's your opinion on that? And they say that energy powers AI, right? We need the energy producers are going to be the ones that are going to really control AI. Could you just give your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we're at a stage right now of human discovery that is totally unprecedented. And I don't use that term lightly. It's the first time ever in the history of humanity that power or energy equals intelligence. It's the ability to have electricity that can be turned into the generation of ideas and thought, right? We can read entire encyclopedia sets in nanoseconds and get to the crux of it. And we can diagnose the human genome, something that would take thousands of scientists, millions of hours looking through binoculars. Your AI can do it and discover medical cures. And so I'm excited about AI, no doubt. Now, there's a little bit of fear there, without a doubt, but I like to liken the fear of AI to those of us of a certain age who grew up pre-internet, which I did. I think you guys may have as well, right? When the internet started becoming a thing, people were a little afraid of it, right? Is the internet going to take everyone's job? Well, I would say the world would argue that the internet has made the world a better and more exciting place. Look at us talking right now because of the internet, right? So I think there's some AI fear that is a little irrational. What does scare me, though, is the wrong people getting their hands on it. And that is, we control the internet. Right? America controlled the internet from its inception. We have to do the same with AI. And to do that, we need a tremendous amount of energy. It's also part of President Trump's energy dominance agenda. We need a lot of power, and we need power very, very quickly brought online so we can dominate this industry for good.
If energy equals power, does weakening domestic fossil fuel production strengthen our adversaries?
100%. It makes our adversaries, the more they have energy over us, the stronger they become, right? And I just mentioned how energy is now intelligence, but energy is also the military, right? Energy is military might. It's supply chains. If we can go back to that one little period of COVID insanity where everyone was in panic mode about their goods and supply chain disruption, what didn't get disrupted was our energy. Men and women were still working in oil and gas and coal, but you had the tools to do what you needed to when the government gave you permission, right? If the energy is gone, then none of that matters. And those are all those post-apocalyptic shows that are, you know, from Walking Dead to that's what all that stuff has fascinated people. What would the world be without energy? What would the world look like? If America is energy weak, or energy poor, all we are is weak. And we were under Biden, right? When you can't afford the excess of just filling up your tank of gas, well, then your economy is depressed and people are depressed, right? When you are energy rich, you have abundance and prosperity. In the case of America, that is peace and that is economic opportunity for more people. But in the case of our adversaries, when they're energy rich, it's violence, it's war, it's terrorism, it's bloodshed. And so that's the difference between us and them, and that's why we have to win.
Well, just let alone from a national security standpoint, I remember I was still on active duty getting ready to retire when the Biden administration came out with their, they are pretty much mandating EVs for all of our armored vehicles and a plan to convert, you know, all the, you know, the tanks, you know, the troop carriers, things like, you know, all the heavy armor systems and vehicles to EV. We're all just like, that's an absolute disaster and pretty much a pipe dream to begin with. So very good insight on that.
It's just insanity. And we may get there one day. I called my organization Power the Future for a reason. I don't know what the future holds in terms of energy, but I know that right now we live an energy, fossil fuel, robust life. And if we punish our fossil fuels now, we're not getting a brighter tomorrow. We're not going to hasten a better tomorrow. So telling the military under Lloyd Austin and Jennifer Granholm, Energy Secretary, you're going to switch to EV tanks, right? Making you use it does not make it a quality tank. What makes it a quality tank are the men and women geniuses who are playing with these things and perfecting them and making them lethal. I love when Secretary Hegseth talks about lethality, making them lethal and then giving them to the military for use. You know, when it comes to EVs, I tell people all the time, I think it was Car and Driver or I forget what magazine, they had the EV Ford F-150 Lightning, which Biden drove around the parking lot and told everyone this is the Ford of the future. Someone hooked up an empty two-horse trailer to it, and it died within like 60 miles. You know, I haul tens of thousands of pounds of sheep longer than 60 miles. What the hell am I supposed to do if I'm like a real cattle farmer? And I'm a real sheep farmer, but if you're a cattle farmer, what are you supposed to do, right? So telling people we're going to punish the regular Ford and we're going to give you a $7,500 coupon to buy the electric Ford doesn't make it the machine I need. All it does is create chaos. Donald Trump took away the chaos. Ford stopped making the F-150 Lightning. I'm not celebrating that. I'm just saying the president of the United States doesn't know how to make flipping cars. The car people does. And the president of the United States doesn't know how to make tanks. The military does. Let them do their damn job and give them the tools now to do it. And those tools right now are fossil fuels.
All right, Daniel, you bring up a lot of good points. We want to bring up something. I'm sure you've seen the series Landman on season one when it was Billy Bob Thornton's character was telling the attorney for the oil company about all the windmills and just, you know, all being put up, driving over Texas. You see them all over the place. And I thought he did a very good job actually explaining the oil and gas industry. If windmills were profitable and windmills were truly, you know, the way of the future, do you not think, was it the every major oil company like the BP, the Chevrons, I mean, you name and even all the mid-sized ones, do you not think they would be putting up thousands, about tens of thousands of those every chance they got if they actually were going to be profitable and actually would be able to, power our energy levels the way the United States needs them to be able to from a domestic standpoint?
If wind and solar made economic sense, companies would not need laws requiring their adaptation, and they wouldn't need government subsidies to bring them onto market, right? If I'm the electric grid, I just have to produce electricity for the most efficient way possible. It is only when we bring on this force of government that says, by the year 2030, 50% of your electricity has to come from quote-unquote green sources. Well, now the electric grid's in a pickle because it's got to get those green sources from somewhere. So that's when they have to start getting wind and solar. And then the government comes in and says, look, we'll give you all this money to buy wind and solar, but the people are the ones who get screwed in the end. Look at where electricity is the most expensive. They're in the states that have the highest amounts of wind and solar because they're not profitable. They're not economic profitable. And again, power of the future. Maybe they will be one day, but they're not right now. And bringing them online faster than the market has allowed them is not going to make them efficient. It's not going to make them affordable. It's not going to make them better products. And we're punishing our now for this idea of somehow having a better future. And don't even get me started on the green, because they're not remotely green. Green and clean are BS political phrases. They are not rooted in science or truth or fact. And Billy Bob Thornton, in that famous speech, he talks about the amount of fossil fuels required to mine them, manufacture them, install them, lubricate them, service them, that will never be offset in its lifetime. Your EV, the amount of fossil fuels to get your EV running will never be offset in the lifespan of the EV itself. Your solar panel, you know, like this is where the movement can drive me insane. The climate left can make me genuinely filled with bad feelings of hatred, because we're telling people to get a 30-year loan to put on solar panels when the lifespan of them is 18 years. How many Americans took 30-year loans on solar panels for the roof with a company or knows they only last 18 years? So they're not green. They're not clean. They're not. It's all made up crap. And we're punishing Americans for this fake climate agenda. And it's just pure evil.
Yeah, so many great points you brought up today, Daniel. I think maybe we could really sum things up that energy independence is it basically would equal our global security, you know, domestically and abroad.
Energy is everything. It's peace and prosperity. It's the world stability. It's American family well-being. It's human dignity, right? It's the human dignity of having a life that you can afford to live and die in comfort. I'll end with one quick little anecdote, which was my father passed away a couple of years ago. And I tell this all the time when I talk to environmental left, and I say, you know, dad had the same equality that the richest person in the world did. You know, maybe they had nicer private jets and dad flew commercial, but dad got to see the world just like those rich people got to see the world. Fossil fuels are the great equalizer. And when dad died, you know, I was there and he had an IV in his arm, and it was thin and it was rigid and it was hollow and it was made from steel that was forged with coal, and it was connected to tubes that were plastic and non-porous and non-toxic that were made from oil, and it had a gas in them that came from a derivative of natural gas, and it gave dad a peaceful death. Human dignity comes from fossil fuels. Give us human dignity. They give us the ability to live and die ways that European kings of old could have only dreamed of. And so punishing fossil fuels doesn't hasten a better tomorrow. It doesn't hasten world peace or prosperity. All it does is punish our now. So I'll never stop fighting for fossil fuels, for the world, but America first.
Well, you mentioned private jets. I'd love to see the carbon footprint of the private jets that Bernie Sanders and AOC flew around in, talking about the Green New Deal. So, but again, that's a whole other topic of conversation there, folks. So we'll get around to it one of these days. Well, Daniel, well, unfortunately, our time is up. We really want to thank you for this vast knowledge and insight, and being a true subject matter expert on the energy needs requirements, not just from a domestic standpoint, but also abroad. We'll post the information for Power of the Future on how the folks can learn more. If you enjoyed the content from today's episode, please like and subscribe to become a founding member of Proud American Studios. Go to ProudAmericanStudios.com to sign up and to also see what else we are working on. We appreciate you joining us, and we will see you again soon.